This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to
a new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where this evening I have two special featured guests, one of whom, Scott Bennett, is former Army Intel and PsyOps and a whistleblower. The second is Robert O'Dowd, a former Marine, who's talking about the government, the CIA, especially taking out whistleblowers. I therefore thought Scott would be eminently qualified to comment on what Robert has to report, but we're going to begin with Scott, who's been doing a lot of research on what's been going on out in Oregon. Scott, welcome to The Real Deal.
Jim, it's an honor to be with you as always.
I'm really pleased you're here, and you've been doing so much work on what's going on in Oregon. We have a videotape here of the car and the shooting, and perhaps you'd like to give us a little background.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I started looking into this and writing into this for General Independent Analytics, a group, a think tank in Europe, and they're gianalytics.org. So I started writing on this, and I found myself being contacted by the guys up there to help them develop the narrative, help them to form the intel and process this. And I found myself going back into PSYOP mode about strategic communications and all that. So I started having guys report to me about what was going on, and I wrote about three articles. And the next thing I know, Robert Lavoie Finicum is shot and killed. And then I started talking with the Army guys up there that are helping guard the girl, Victoria Sharp. And they said, Scott, we want to do an interview, but we want to do it with you. We don't trust, you know, other people and such. So I said, sure. So we had Victoria Sharp give us a interview on what happened and her whole story. And I talked with the Army guy who went through the whole ambush situation and how the car was set up and the timeline. And we analyzed every detail from every perspective. And the final short version is the FBI tried to do a murder squad on Lavoie Finicum and the people in this car. And it's really the next Waco, as we all knew it would be. And it is also the shot heard around the world, because this man, Lavoie Finicum, has died a martyr. And I think every American who calls themselves American, who's worthy of the title and is worthy of the rights and the constitutional protections and liberties, they have a choice today. And that is, you either stand with this militia group and the Bundys and the Lavoie Finicum family, stand with them, or you stand against them. You either call him a truth teller and an honorable man, or you call him a liar and a dishonorable man. You can't be on the fence anymore, because now we've got blood that's been shed. We've got government troops firing on American citizens and ambushing them. And the media and the politicians are contributing to this. So this is an all-out aggressive strategic operation that we're doing. And the first step is exposing the truth. And the government have hung themselves. They have shot the gunfire that'll be heard around the world. And I think it's the start of the next American Revolution, a quiet one. But I think you're going to have all sorts of smoldering fires start to pop up all over the country. So it's not going to be, you know, the federal government against the West. It's going to be militia groups and independent parties and freedom and constitutional people standing up in every state. And the bad guys are going to be overwhelmed, as they should be.
Well, Scott, now we have a report attributed to Shauna Cox, who was in the vehicle with Lavoie Finicum which she gave on the Dave Hodges show last night. I received a summary from a very reliable correspondent of mine who's proven to be completely accurate in the past. According to her, the Fed set up the situation and executed Finnegan. They started firing on the truck before it stopped in the snowbank. She thinks Finnegan jumped out of the truck immediately to draw fire so the people in the truck wouldn't die. Yeah. But they fired over 100 rounds into the truck after Finnegan was shot dead. Yeah. And she concludes we're living in an overt totalitarian police state. Now, we have a video clip a few minutes long tracing this, Scott, so I thought we'd play it and then have you comment further on the situation.
Certainly. Sounds good.
Chance. After careful examination of the Lavoie-Finnegan video put out by the FBI, we've reached the following conclusions. First, the timestamp on the video does not correspond to the date of the incident, as you can see in the title of the FBI's video. The title says the 26th of January. The timestamp on the video itself in the upper left says the 27th of January. That is a big red flag. The counter on this video next to the date starts at the 25-minute mark, so we have no idea how things led up to the scene that we're actually seeing. This is particularly troubling because allegedly both vehicles, the Jeep and the white truck, were stopped at the same time and then the white truck took off. The movie opens with the white truck traveling down the road, then it stops for about 5 minutes where they pan back to the Jeep about 500 feet away, and yet never do we see the Jeep following the white truck. We just see the white truck take off after about 5 minutes and into the roadblock where officers come out of the forest and shoot the man. This is an important point because we never see the Jeep and the white truck traveling together or get stopped together. What's possibly even more troubling is the description of the title, unedited, but between the 2 and 3 minute marks, we can see the image jump. We can see the image jump to a different location multiple times, which means editing. So the date is wrong and the video is edited. So the description is just way off. They got the date wrong and they got the title wrong because the video was edited. So the entire title is misleading. And this is from the FBI. They might as well have called the video Believe Us, We're Fucking Lying. Then during the actual quote-unquote shootout, we don't actually see muzzle flashes in the negative spectrum. See how nicely things light up in the negative spectrum here in this clip. So there's no actual visual proof that the guns were fired during this mock execution. Even if guns were fired, it looks like the first shots at Lavoie were at the hip, which means that he would react reaching for his hip, which would look like he's reaching for a gun. So at this stage, it is our opinion that they recreated the scene at best, or staged the original scene at worst, which reinforces our theory that this whole standoff was a setup from the beginning. And what we actually saw here was the extraction of the actors before they spraying the trap at the refuge. What remains to be answered here is who investigates the FBI? Who investigates the Department of Justice and our criminal dictator? Are they above the law? Well, they might as well be. And we might as well be in Nazi Germany, folks. They can stage a shooting, recreate the scene, and have it look like a total lie, and nobody can do anything. That's how bold the tyranny is these days. They've been busted time and again staging false flags, and this is just another chapter in their playbook. Mock siege, fake killings, while releasing videos to provoke the public. This is outrageous. They need to answer some important questions here, and Congress should open an inquiry immediately on the obvious fakery of the entire situation. They can call it Bundygate or Obamagate. Call it whatever they want, but we need the entire country to focus on this outlandish perversion of justice. Be sure to mirror and repost this video at will. And if you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Now, Scott, in addition, we have a report from Blaine Cooper, who claims that Lavoie Finnegan left his weapons at the refuge center before leaving on the trip that led to his death. And I've seen multiple videos where he gets out of the vehicle, he raises his hands in a form of surrender, and appears to reach down to his left hip, but I believe that may be after he's actually been shot, because he was clearly posing no threat. Do you have further observations about this sequence of events?
Yeah, well, you're right, and it's coming right from the horse's mouth. Victoria Sharp, who sat down with us for 2.5 hours and did an interview, and I sent you the link, and it's also on YouTube. The link I just sent you, the audio is a little bit better to hear because they were trying to stop our interview with all sorts of internet shutdowns and stuff. But Victoria Sharp, one of the young 18-year-old girl who was in the car, who had been a singer for this group, You have to follow the whole narrative to understand the military intelligence sort of dimension of this. This was an ambush, and here's why. This car was full of the leadership of the operation. Lavoie and Amon Bundy and his brother and Victoria and the Shauna woman and a couple other people. And they were going up to Grant County to talk to a room full of people, a big auditorium full of Grant County personalities. And the sheriff of Grant County had invited them. So they are the opposite of what you had at Harney County. At Harney County, you had some good people who wanted them there. You also had the FBI, the Judge Grasty, and the sheriff trying to stop it. And they were corrupting it, and it was just a mess. So the leadership was trying to get people out of Harney County. That was, that became Dunkirk, and they needed to get out and go back and reconnoiter and base and all that. So they were going to go up to Grant County, and they were on their way up to make the petition to sort of, request and talk. And the feds and the intel people knew that that was in process. They could hear it. They knew it was coming. And they knew if the leadership got out and got up to Grant County and was successful, they would basically have won the chess game, because all the people would have got out of the Malheur Refuge, similar to that film Last of the Mohicans, where all the British leave the fort and they leave it to the French. The same thing would have happened, and they would have done it with a pomp and circumstance, cowboys on their horses, their flags, their guns on their hip, and they would have went up to Grant County. And the federal government would have looked like a loser, and they knew they couldn't do that. So they followed Bundy and Lavoie Finicum and the car, and it's a lesson in operations, too. You never go with just two cars. They should have had a convoy of people for protection and for witnesses. Instead, they just had two cars. So they're driving up to Grant County, and that's when the trap is sprung, and Oregon State Police and FBI follow Bundy's car. He's in the rear, and the white car holding Lavoie Finicum and Victoria Sharp is in front. And the feds and the Oregon police pull up behind and stop Amon Bundy. And some of these may be a little bit, out of order and stuff like that. I'm trying to remember exactly what she said, but in a nutshell, it's all absolutely true verbatim from her. The cops get Amon Bundy out of the car, and they arrest him, I think, on a warrant, a probable cause warrant, right? It's like, well, we think he may have done something wrong, so we're issuing a warrant for him. And they put him in the back of the car. And Lavoie Finicum and Victoria Sharp and Shauna are in the white truck, and the engine's still running. Now, the Ryan Bundy, or the brother of Bundy, had said, had put his hands outside the window because the cops had their guns drawn, right? And they were all aiming at the vehicle. And I think Bundy had said, or Lavoie had said, we're on our way to Grant County. Don't stop us. Don't interfere. We're not in trouble for anything. Let us go. We're on our way. Don't impede us. Something to that effect. So he challenged them, as any constitutional American is allowed to do. That's why we live in a free country. We're not in Nazi Germany showing papers. And they didn't like that. And they kept saying, stop, get out of the car, things like that. Well, anyway, Bundy's brother said, we've got women in the car. And he puts his hands out. Well, someone took a shot at him, right, when he's in the car. So someone shot at Bundy in the car, because he pulled in. Victoria said he pulled in and said, oh, my God, they shot at me. Don't make me go out there. And that's when Lavoie took off. So they were shot at, Jim. They were shot at. Everything changed at that moment. Suddenly, you're in a survival mode. You either fly and leave, or you fight, or you die. And Lavoie chose to flee and get out of there because he had been shot at. And he didn't know what was going down. They had no reason to shoot at them whatsoever. These people aren't being chased for robbing a bank or killing or raping someone. These people are in a car going up to Grant County, and they've been in contact and serving coffee to the FBI for a week or 2 weeks. They've been there since November. So what the heck is this? And you shoot. Now, here's the other thing.
I want you to add that. What is the overt legal justification for blockading the road in the first place?
Well, here's now we're getting up to the blockade. So that shows that it was a setup. It was a total premeditated operation. And they shoot at Lavoie's car, and he takes off. Now, here's what I'll call him Ghost, who's an Army guy up there taking care of Victoria, has downloaded and debriefed me on this operation. And he said, Scott, we all know from a military background, ambushes are set up this way. You set up a choke point up in front, and then you drive your targets from the rear by shooting at them. They run up towards your ambush point. So you've got a kill zone.
Stampeded.
You've got the kill zone all set up. You know exactly where they need to go to kill them. And you drive them by shooting at them, you know, flashbangs, whatever it is, bad language or flamethrowers. But whatever you need to do, you got to get these people moving, whether they're Iraqi terrorists or what. We've all gone through this and know it. So he said this was an ambush. They shot at the car to send them on their way. And that's what they did. That's what happened. So they shot at the car. Lavoie takes off, and the girls and everybody's on the ground. And she said they were firing at the vehicle. So this wasn't just, you know, I'm going to keep going my way. This was sitting still, and suddenly bullets start being shot at the car. Well, of course you're going to take off. And they do that. And the guy drives, and he goes up around the corner after like a minute or so. And that's where you saw the ambush. Now, he went around a corner. So the ambush was set up so you couldn't see it from a distance. Once you get around the corner, boom, you're right there in the ambush. And he had like 100 feet or something, 3 seconds, two and a half to 3 seconds to make a move. Now, they set up the ambush where the two vehicles were forming a sort of pressing their hoods together as a sort of a plow shape, a triangle shape. And then there was a car behind those two cars. So the theory was in ambushes, the car being chased is going to hit the two cars that are formed sort of, you know, like that. And then that car is going to push through and hit the third car, which is in the middle. So it's all about setting up shock absorption. So you stop this car from being able to escape the ambush. And that's what they had set up. So they called ahead the guys who arrested Bundy. They called ahead to the ambush and said, they're leaving. We're chasing them. And they've got women in the car. So they knew there were women in the car. They hadn't been shot at. They were just chasing them. So they're chasing Bundy up. Bundy comes around. He runs right into an ambush. And, of course, he veers to the left. You're going 40 to 60 miles an hour. He veers to the left. He barely misses the cars, and he goes into a snowbank. Now, here's interesting, Jim. You see an agent jump out into the snow and fire a weapon into the windshield. That agent could have been killed, according to Ghost. He said had Lavoie really wanted to get through that ambush, he would have just gone through on the side of the road and knocked one of the cars over without going into deep snow, and he would have been able to get through. He probably would have killed that agent. But it tells you something. Lavoie was sparing the life of that agent. He didn't want to kill the agent. He didn't want to run him over. Even though the man shot a gun in his windshield, Lavoie still moved the car to the left and avoided running this agent over. So he turns the car to the left, and he, boom, goes into a snowbank, and the car almost tips but doesn't quite. Shots are starting to now be shot at the car. Victoria said all sorts of bullets were coming from the front and from the side. From the left side, and on the left side,
and yet the occupants of the vehicle haven't fired a single shot.
Had not fired a single shot. So the tree line is full of FBI agents in camo uniform and black suit operations, and in front, and you had a drone drone. That was
this might have been setting up Bonnie and Clyde, for God's sake.
That's how they treated the car. It was riddled with bullets, and the photos need to come through. Lavoie was shot 9 times, as I've been reported, as I've heard. 9 times. Now, Victoria said that the narrative is Victoria said they came to the snowbank, they were stopped, and they were shooting through the windshield. Lavoie gets out of the car, and he gets in the big deep snow, and he throws his hands up, and he goes over to the side, and everyone who's military have said that's an effort to draw fire away from the car. So he was going to draw fire away from the women in the car. He went over knowing all guns would be trained on him, and he would pull the guns off the car. That's a hero. And he goes over to the snow, and he's got his hands up. And he says, apparently, just shoot me, whether it's a sacrifice or what, or just a taunt. Hey, just shoot me. And he doesn't have a weapon. He doesn't make any moves. He's stumbling. And you can't see it from that video, but he's still being shot at. And that's what Victoria says, because she's listening and the gunfire is going. And she said she heard this pop, pop, pop. That's when he reaches down to his left, which means he's been hit in the left. And then the other shooting hits him in the head and he goes down. And then they keep shooting him. They keep shooting him on the ground. He's shot 9 times, supposedly. So that'll all come out in the coroner's report of his body. But now he's dead on the ground. Now, here's the thing, Jim. They edited out of the video. They shot at that car for like another 1 to 3 minutes, riddling it with bullet holes, trying to kill everybody in that.
How did they manage to survive, Scott?
Well, God's hands was on them, I'd say. And also, they were smart to get low. It was a reinforced car. So, I mean, they survived an incredible.
They were lucky. The feds wouldn't want witnesses who could report what actually happened.
Yeah. And I think what happened too was you probably had the state of Oregon troopers saying, cease fire. What the fuck? What are you doing? Cease fire.
Yeah.
And I mean, these are their people. They're in the state of Oregon. They're not FBI flown in from Washington DC. That's a bunch of psychopaths brought off the battlefield from Afghanistan or Iraq, treating Americans like their next Wahhabi jihadi target. These are Oregon State Police. They've went to town hall meetings. They've grown cattle. They were all raised in that land since little boys, and they're seeing their fellow citizens get shot up by these FBI thug Nazis, and they stop it. And the drone is going overhead too, and they go, uh-oh. So they stop shooting, and they tell Victoria, you know, get out of the car, get out of the car. They're yelling, Victoria, I mean, this went on for minutes. She said, we surrender, we surrender. And they said, you know, get out of the car. So she gets out of the car, and she sees Lavoie over there, and she says, I'm an EMT. I'm an emergency medical technician. I'm an EMT. Let me help him. And the red bearded guy goes, and I think you can see him on some other video footage. You see this red bearded FBI kid. I think that's the one and we'll find out. We'll find out everybody who was there. This FBI guy grabbed Victoria's hair, right? And yanks her back and yells in her ear. You know what? This isn't a bank robber. This is a young girl, for God's sake. You have no decency or humanity. You're going to grab a young girl and yell in her ear like she's some sort of a thug or murderer. My God, it's so appalling that this is what people call America and American law enforcement. And it's so sickening that the media and the American citizenry as a whole aren't aware of this and don't have enough guts and intelligence to dig into it. But I don't want to digress. So she comes over and she says, I can help him. And the guy says, no, we've got enough medical guys here. Bullshit. They don't do a damn thing. They don't give him any help. And they sit her down. They handcuff her. They then get the other people out of the car. Bundy's brother, incidentally, when they were shooting the car up after Lavoie was shot, that's when Bundy's brother got hit in the arm. Now, Jim, they're not shooting. They're in a car hunkered down, you know, covering their head saying, we surrender. Stop for the love of God. And Bundy gets hit with a bullet in the shoulder. This is America. Yeah. This is the FBI.
I'm telling you, I can't imagine a better introduction to the issues that Robert's going to be addressing, because it's not just the FBI, it's a CIA, it's a whole bloody government, corrupt from stem to stern.
And she says the guys went over to Lavoie's body and were joking and laughing and just treating it like someone killed a big buck. It was just a good old time. And she said the only nice person was the Oregon State Police guy who tapped her on the shoulder and said it's going to be okay. And apparently now all this is coming out, and the people of Harney are demanding that the FBI commander be arrested and prosecuted, Judge Grassley be arrested and prosecuted, Sheriff Ward be arrested, prosecuted. And you can make, I mean, they've done so many bad things. You could just throw darts at a board and you can find laws they violated.
Well, I think it's stupendous that you've been digging into this, Scott, and can give us such a detailed report, because substantiated with all the videos, and there are multiple videos.
Yeah.
And in some, you can see the flashes from the guns being fired, the weapons being fired, Scott. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of evidence here.
Yeah.
And it's a small enough situation with few enough parties that you absolutely are going to be able to identify who roughly fired every shot and at what time in the situation that was taking place. I commend you for an excellent summary. Now, Robert.
Yes.
I'm going to infer that you heard nothing there that surprises you at all when it comes to the depravity of the American government treating anyone who wants to stand up for the Constitution, or in the case of those you've been studying, wants to blow the whistle on governmental corruption.
Well, sadly enough, that's true, Jim. Scott gave a great explanation of that. I mean, it's unbelievable. And these are FBI agents, you know, our most trained, you would think, you know, police force, right? Shooting at unarmed people. No one in that car had any weapons. You know, I mean, my God, they had to be on.
They didn't even have weapons. And the FBI is reporting that he was reaching for weapons when it's clear he did not have a weapon to reach for. So, you know, the lies, the depth of the deception, the corruption here is simply overwhelming.
Yeah.
Scott, I'm very glad you're going to be staying by, because Robert has so much to say that I know you're going to want to comment on. Being a whistleblower yourself, he's going to talk about what's happened to some in the past. Robert, why don't you begin now?
Thanks, Jim. Well, Scott and Jim, feel free to jump in at any time with any questions or thoughts on this thing. Guns down, drugs up. That was the mantra used for the Iran-Contra situation, except to the extent that the American people do not realize, hey, know about the guns that went south to support the Contras in Nicaragua, who were fighting supposedly against the Sandinistas. But they don't know about the drugs coming up for the most part. We're not talking about, you know, prescription drugs. We're talking about cocaine. And they don't know that CIA proprietary airlines that were flying the drugs into military bases, which is unbelievable. Unfortunately, what happened is the men who did know about that and found out about it at the last moment, like Colonel Jim Sabo, wound up dead, and others. So, Chance, next slide, please. Celie Castillo, DEA agent, has 12 years in the field. Celie was a Vietnam vet. We were about the same age. Most of that was, I'm not sure how many years he spent in South America and Central America. He's a Spanish American, born in Texas. Celie, really knows the jungle. He knows the jungle in Vietnam. He knew the jungle in Central and South America. And he got a call from one of his agents in Guatemala to go down and take a look at the Elapango Air Force Base. And it cracked my Spanish if it's all fair a little bit, because they thought that the Contras were running guns and drugs back into the States. And what he finds out is, oh, yes, they are. And he's copying down the tail numbers. Now, it goes up to about 1986. He's at a cocktail party in the ambassador's home when George Bush is there, Vice President George Bush. He introduces himself, Mr. Vice President. Oh, by the way, Mr. Vice President, do you realize that there are C-130 aircrafts flying out of here with lots of cocaine in them? Bush quickly turns on his heels and walks away. Now, Celie's a good cop. He knows right away, this guy's dirty. He's dirty.
It's a wonder Seeley didn't get killed because he keeps sending his reports up. The ambassador says, look, Seeley, you can't do this. It's a White House thing. And Seeley says, I don't care if it's a Red House thing. The reports are going forward. This is a felony. They're flying in all this darn cocaine. He didn't know they were going into U.S. military bases, but he knew they were going into the United States. And they knew there were
What a perfect cover, right, Robert?
Oh, you can't get a better cover.
Military planes to transport these drugs from one base to another.
It's a perfect cover. You're flying in. You got transponder codes to get across the border. No one's going to take you down from customs. You get onto the base. It's already locked in with the trucks coming in. Whoever they may have been, either CIA operatives or drugsters. In fact, El Toro, which of course Jim, you know where that's at. Right off of the I-405, as they say in California. It's about 41 miles south of L.A. Perfect, right? And where does the big drug thing start, really? The crack cocaine epidemic starts in L.A. with Freeway Ricky Ross. Getting a little bit ahead of myself a little bit. But, and the other thing, here's an interesting thing also. None of these drug guys, for the most part, they're black or maybe Hispanic. None of them are college graduates. So how to the hell do they take cocaine and break it down to crack, cocaine? I don't think any of them had any chemistry courses, right? So who told them how to do that? And if you're going to sell a gram of cocaine in 1982, it's going for about roughly $250. Where are you going to sell it at? Not South Central LA. No way. Now, you could sell crack cocaine for about maybe $25 or $30, and that's what they had to do. Next slide.
Oh, was some of this going to Hollywood?
Yes, some could, Hollywood, Malibu, not by freeway. All they did, eventually what happened was I think the Hollywood folks would come to freeway once they found out we could get, cocaine from this guy. But he couldn't sell it in the ghetto. It was just too expensive. And, now freeway, he'll tell you that another drug dealer told him how to make it, maybe, but then who told that guy, eventually.
Robert, I think you have a video here, if I'm not mistaken. Just tell Chance when we're ready to have it played.
Fire away, Chance. Go fire away this video. This is an interesting video. It's some in Spanish and some in English, but the subtitles will tell you what's going on. These are three DEA agents who talk about the murder of Kiki Camarena, who's an ex-Marine also, who was abducted and kidnapped in 1985 in Mexico and tortured for 3 days with a tire iron. He's beaten badly. Every bone in his body is broken. In fact, at one time had to inject lidocaine into his heart to keep him alive. Kiki,
and they were torturing him for the reason that
because he got too close to the cocaine issue. He's following the drug money. Where's this money going to? Who's getting the money? Who's running this stuff?
Was he actually a DEA agent?
Yes, he was a DEA agent.
Okay.
Yes, he was.
Okay, and go for it, Chance.
This documentary's testimonial were presented under oath in courts of the United States of America.
El ex líder del cártel de Jalisco ya se encuentra libre.
One of Mexico's most infamous drug lords has been freed from prison.
Rafael Caro Quintero fue conocido como el narco de narcos, considerado responsable del surgimiento en México del tráfico de drogas a gran escala hacia los Estados Unidos.
El Departamento de Estado ofreció hoy una recompensa de $5 millones por información que permita detener y condenar a Rafael Caro Quintero.
¿Qué esperas hacer cuando salgas de la cárcel?
Primeramente yo pienso hacer muchas cosas, ¿cierto?
Caro Quintero dominated drug dealing. Enrique Camarena infiltrated his cell, and his investigation led to the forfeiture of thousands of tons of marijuana at El Buffalo Ranch. On February 1985, Enrique Camarena was abducted, tortured, and killed. To investigate what happened and who did it, the DEA started Operation Legend. After almost 30 years, the truth about what happened has never been told, until now.
Yo fui el director de Operación Leyenda, criada por la DEA para investigar el secuestro, tortura y homicidio de Enrique Camarena.
For the first time, witnesses and ex-DEA agents break the silence to let the world know the facts behind NARC's empire.
¡Órale, hijo de puta madre! ¡Vete! ¡Detérmelo, cabrón! Estuve en el interrogatorio de Enrique Camarena, lo tenían en una cama, vendado y con las manos atadas atrás. Le daban de golpes en la cara, en todo el cuerpo, y le brincaban sobre el cuerpo.
Él ya no respondía nada, pues. Ya se miraba bien agotado. Él fue torturado aproximadamente entre 8 y 10 horas.
Ex-DEA agents denounced the CIA of being involved in NARC's operations.
La CIA, sin duda, tenía conocimiento en las operaciones de Caro Quintero, en el tráfico de droga, y dio evidencia que estuvieron involucrados en el asesinato de Quique Camarena.
La CIA estaba coluida con los narcotraficantes, específicamente con el cartel de Guadalajara.
People under the Witnesses Program reveal how Mexican cops were reduced to narcs thugs.
Sí, efectivamente, yo era de gente de la policía judicial. Me asignaron a la protección del narcotraficante Ernesto Fonseca Carrillo.
Yo le comenté a mi jefe de grupo que cómo es posible que nosotros nos estemos prestando a protegerlos a ellos, que ellos eran unos delincuentes y que estaban ejecutando gente en delante de nosotros. Y él me contestó, no podemos hacer nada porque todo el gobierno está metido desde arriba.
Former agents present powerful evidence about corruption on the highest levels of government.
La corrupción y el gobierno está colindado desde arriba de los del PRI.
El principal era Manuel Bartlett Díaz.
Que él les otorgaba las credenciales de la Secretaría de Gobernación a Rafael Caro Quintero, firmadas por él.
Miguel de la Madrid, actual presidente, cuando yo entré ahí, me comentó Caro Quintero y Fonseca que mes con mes le tenían que enviar sus kilos de cocaína para su uso.
La investigación del asesinato de Enrique Camarena fue el Watergate mexicano, porque por primera vez se comprobó que gobernantes del PRI estaban coludidos con el narcotráfico.
And they speak not only about Mexico, but about America too.
Félix Rodríguez fue una persona que siempre estaba dedicando su carrera en la CIA, una persona que torturaba gente. Hay testigos que dicen que estuvo él ahí torturando a Quique Camarena, un agente especial de nosotros de la DEA.
Oliver North, teniente coronel, desde el Pentágono, dirigía las actividades ilícitas de Félix Rodríguez en el movimiento de narcodólares para fomentar la guerrilla y del movimiento de la droga que se introducía a los Estados Unidos.
Startling revelations responding to outrageous questions. Why didn't Oliver North never set foot in jail? Who trained the Zetas? Who killed Che Guevara? Who planned the death of Enrique Camarena? A documentary film that dares to expose shocking truths behind the power.
Sin duda, la CIA traicionó a Enrique Camarena y le causó su muerte.
Operation Legend, coming soon.
Okay.
Robert, do you think that Oliver North, therefore, had a role to play in Quique Camarena's death?
Well, he could have, because he was still at the NSC. This is 1985. He's not fired until 1986. Interesting enough, we know that somebody else did, and that was Felix Rodriguez, who knew North and who knew George Bush. Felix Rodriguez is a Cuban refugee, naturalized American, you know, citizen, retired Army colonel, Vietnam vet, a member. He was also in the Phoenix program in Vietnam. He's a brutal killer. There isn't any question about it. And the DEA agents point out that he was there. And you know, you don't have to be charged with murder to be actually the guy that actually pulls the trigger. If you're a part of the effort going on to kill somebody, you could be charged with it. Now, Rodriguez claims he's going to sue these guys, et cetera, so forth and so on. But interesting enough that Caro Quintero was released in 2013 he had a 40-year sentence for murder in Mexico, and the extradition request from the United States was never honored. He gets out in 2013 after 28 years, whereabouts now unknown, if he's still alive.
And Scott, I gather You had even instruction about from DOJ about CIA drug ops with the Mossad.
Funny you should say that, Jim. I don't know where you would get that, but yeah, right here is the Department of Justice manual taught by Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer under the guidance of Mr. Obama, that it's called Deep Black, the CIA's Secret Drug Wars, Part 1, by David Guyatt, 1997. I'll send you a copy of this. In fact, it's in my book, Shell Game, which you Google Shell Game by Scott Bennett, and I put this in here. This was a class, no joke, that when they put me into a halfway house. Rob, you wouldn't believe the story that what they've done to me, but they put a termite into a tree and not knowing it was a termite, and I bore through all this, and I was put into a halfway house, and they're teaching this to inmates. The Department of Justice is teaching this to inmates, that CIA has been doing deep black drug operations with Mossad, killing American service members who get too close, killing journalists who get too close, doing all sorts of unconstitutional, evil things. They're teaching this to prisoners and inmates who've been in jail for 25, 30 years. To what? To why? What's the purpose? Well, you can only speculate. It's to cause more hatred for the government by these guys, to make them want to go out and kill more cops and go back to jail or do all sorts of police state provocateur stuff. But the mere fact that they are teaching this class prompted me to write Judge Virginia Hernandez Covington in Florida and say, they're teaching this class. I'm asking you as the judge in the federal court to immediately investigate this sua sponte and just determine, one, if it's fake, then it's brainwashing and they're harming inmates. Two, if it's real, then you immediately file a complaint and a sua sponte investigation that the CIA and the Department of Justice are involved with unconstitutional activities. Well, Judge Virginia Hernandez Covington ignored my motion and has denied me ever since any opportunity to talk. But you couldn't make this stuff up, and I just wanted to share it because it confirms what you're talking about, Robert.
Well, Scott, it's horrifying. You're bringing it up to a federal judge, and she's suppressing the information, obviously a part of the entire corrupt system that would appear to lead right up to the Attorney General and President of the United States.
Jim, we need to have these people in front of some sort of senatorial, congressional, or people's common law court and allow us to tell this truth and allow these buggers to be in a dock to say, Judge, you got this. Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer, you taught this. What have you got to say? How does this benefit the American people? How can you even live? And you may not very much longer after the people in the court of public opinion determines that you're guilty of treason, but they're all part of this. That's the only thing you can describe. And I mean, the Bush family, they're up to their eyeballs in this. Gene Chip Tatum has talked about a lot of that.
This is a sensational compliment to Robert's report.
Yeah, any question about it? I mean, you're talking about corruption. The web just goes right through the entire system. I mean, it's a question of where do you start, you know?
Yeah. Well, persevere. We have a new slide up.
We keep going. Okay, we're talking about the crack cocaine epidemic, which, of course, killed probably thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands. I don't know how many people that got locked up or in jail from it. And all as a result of to do one thing, to get money to fund the war. Because what happened was, and I guess on the slides we're here, but the Bolin Amendment, cut off the use of appropriated funds to fund a war in Nicaragua that the American people didn't want to get involved in. The Vietnam War was over. We left sour.
Robert, where does that money go? Scott may know the answer too. I mean, you know, the CIA.
It didn't all go to Nicaragua, I can tell you that. When we're talking, I looked at one thing. We'll talk later on. There's a couple of shipments that came into El Toro that one CIA pilot said there were about between El Toro and Homestead Air Force Base. He knows of 40 tons of cocaine. Now the street value of that would be about over $2 billion. Now, this guy also says, and this is Plumlee, Robert Tosh Plumlee. I don't know if you know him, but right, he has pretty good. His credibility is there.
He's talking
about 50 pilots being involved in this. We're talking about at least maybe 40 or 50 C-130s. These are C-130s A's that have a payload of about 10,000 pounds. You know, how much cocaine came into this country, how much was sold, how much billions of dollars were made, how much one actually went back to the Contras to be used in their efforts, which were kind of futile anyway. But it probably went into the politicians, it went into the Bush family, it went into others, the payoffs. I mean, Ollie North may have got a piece of it, for all I know. I have no idea. There's just too much money involved. When you have that kind of money involved, you can buy anybody off.
Scott, I take it you view this the same way, Robert. I'm just curious who's getting all the big bucks.
Well, see, that's the thing that got Kiki and killed. He was trying to follow the money trail.
Right. And Scott, why did Scott add his two cents?
Yeah, I mean, I started getting close to it, U.S. Central Command, and finding out where the money was going in all of our counterterrorism operations that Dov Zakheim, my boss, was in charge of. Now, none of them knew who I was. They thought I was part of their corporation. They thought I had been, you know, properly brainwashed to be part of their whole illegal syndicate. And the reality was I was a spy amongst spies. I was Colonel Jeff Jones's private mercenary that he sent me in there to expose and do a lot of stuff. And when I started,
God, it's a wonder you have survived intact.
Well, it is. People have said that, but of course I say, you know, God has got me, and I never talk anything about top secret, and everything else that I have talked about and got, I've backed up and made sure there's insurance policies that should anything happen to me. There's all sorts of stuff that'll come out that Birkenfeld had given me about all the Swiss bank accounts that are tied in with the Abdullah Aziz and the Saudi Arabians and the Kuwaitis and the Qataris and the Bahrainis and all the money that they've got going into ISIS that come from UBS and HSBC that are tied to Covington and Burling and all the bad guys.
Good. Those are some leads. Robert, pick it up.
Okay, next chart, if you will, Chance. Let's go to the next one, see what's going on. You kind of beat this one to death. We could get a million charts on this thing. This is looking what happens over time. This is 1970.
High school seniors?
High school seniors. Yeah, I picked one out. This is an accident, but it's not really an accident. High school seniors, the sale of crack cocaine to high school seniors. Now I'm not talking about adults here, obviously, right? The rise 84, 85, 87 time frame. That's when the Boland Amendment was kind of kicking in, right? So bring in the cocaine, guys. We got to make some money. And they're selling this stuff. It's pretty cheap, relatively speaking, probably as low as $10 a crack, you know.
Yeah, but just think of how many lives are being destroyed by somebody making big shots.
Well, you know what you do is you smoke this stuff. And apparently, to make it, it doesn't, you know, if you take, you know, pure cocaine, you mix it with baking soda and water and you cook it. And then when it hardens into a crystal, and those crystals are put into a pipe and then you smoke it. The danger is that when you smoke it, it reaches the brain in about 8 seconds. What this does to the body is incredible. I mean, the dopamine infusion is unbelievable. Talk about a high, but it only lasts for roughly maybe 10 or 15 minutes. So you go back for more hits. Now these are kids getting this stuff. They're going back. And what are they going to do? They're going to rob. They're going to steal. Maybe kill, okay? And this goes on and on. So it's a terrible habit. This isn't like your Malibu guy that's got $100 million and you're like sniffing some cocaine to get a high. This is really bad stuff. Crack cocaine is more addictive than pure cocaine. Very, 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 very dangerous stuff. Chance, next slide.
Very bad.
Next slide, please. Okay, well, we know where this is. We know where Nicaragua is, but I had it on the chart just to kind of remind myself. They weren't just flying out of El Salvador, also flying out of Costa Rica, and which is, of course, south of Nicaragua. But,
have there been death squads in all these countries?
The extreme right. No kidding. The extreme right was just knocking people off left and right. We're funding the bad guys. You know, you wonder why the leftists got involved in this thing, because, you know, the dictators down there were just killing everybody that they possibly could. They were killing priests. They were killing nuns. They were killing anybody who was a threat to anyone that would expose them. So armed with our weapons, of course. So, it went on and on. Of course, now we also have on the flip side too, you had, maybe in defense, the Salvadorians were bringing in the Cubans, and they had that one time as a real chance of a pretty good war going on. But apparently that, you know, this war goes on from 1979 to 1990. It's over by June 1990. Yet, guess what? The planes keep flying. you got a good deal going. You're not going to shut it off, you know?
If there was some universal vacuum that could just suck up all the weapons we've distributed around the world, it would transform life on Earth.
Well, some of this stuff, Scott, or was it not Scott, but Tosh Ponlietzel was telling me about, I forget what airborne, they were doing an exercise someplace in Central America, maybe Panama. And I forget, maybe the 82nd Airborne went down to do the exercise, and the weapons were lost. Like, what's the term for it? And when you lose something, I forget the term the military uses for it.
Unaccounted for. Unaccounted.
Right. Well, there's another term they use for it, but there's a massive amount of weapons lost on paper, right? But they're actually there. So, and what happened was he flew in to pick the weapons back up, and they went to, Marine Corps base in Southern California and wasn't Camp Pendleton, one of the bases that was used to, retool weapons. And then he, when they were retooled, he picks them up and flies them back through El Toro back down again. So, and at times they were exchanging weapons right to the cartels for drugs. It just, forget the bypassing the Contras, they go right to the cartels. Next slide, please. Chance, next slide.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess this is the background. We already know the background. In 1979, Somoza, who was one of the people that Jim was talking about, not really a good guy. He's overthrown by the socialists, by the Sandinistas. And of course, Reagan comes into office and he has this thing about, you know, we've got to get rid of the Sandinistas and they're a threat to the hemisphere. They have this Marxist-Leninist, philosophy, and they could spread their communist ideas and we'll all turn into red pinkies or something. Next slide.
It's amazing to me how little faith we have in democracy and capitalism that we think anyone putting up a website can immediately convert the youth of America to their cause. It's bizarre.
It is bizarre. It doesn't make any sense. This is from Reagan's library, the NSDD 17 National Security Decision Directive, which really gave the authority to provide funds to a 500-man force of Nicaraguan rebels, if you will, not to overthrow the government on paper, all right? I mean, they actually, I think Casey was the CIA director at this time and went to Congress to brief the intelligence committees and tell them, well, no, we're just going to fund these guys so they can cut off the flow of weapons from El Salvador or from Nicaragua into El Salvador. That's the reason for this. We're not trying to overthrow the government of El Salvador. Total bullshit. Total bullshit. That was the game plan from day one was to do that. Get rid of these guys and put our guys back in again. Next slide. We got quite a few slides just running. This is just a copy of the National Decision Directive. Chance, next slide, please. And of course, I like to see what the redacted stuff says, but we can't do that. Again, the administration's attempt was to supply weapons and support the Contras to overthrow the leftist Nicaraguan government. Okay, who are you going to put in? A good government. Yeah, right. Good for whom? Good for the Americans? I don't think so. Good for corporations?
Sadistic dictator, maybe a general who's a sadomasochist.
Exactly. Of course, naturally, because of their location, the Contras, who many of them are part of drug cartels anyway, had easy access to the drug cartels, and the easy solution for them was to trade drugs for guns and money, of course, and then through the sale of cocaine. And obviously, the sale of cocaine in the United States, even in a covert operation, is a felony. And that's where Kiki's coming from. Kiki, in fact, told Tosh Mali in a restaurant one place in the Southwest, you may be working for the CIA as a contract employee, but what you're doing is a felony and you can get locked up for that. So Tosh gets scared and goes to Senator Gary Hart and tells him his story and says, hey, look, you guys are going to lock me out. What the hell is going on? I'm just working for the government. And, of course, he's vetted and, by Gary Hart's staff, and Hart finds him to have this guy is credible and, passes the information on to Senator John Kerry, who had a subcommittee who was looking at terrorism at this time. And I tell you what, Tosh Plumlee, of course, Jim knows him, right? Tosh Plumlee, I don't know if he's a high school graduate. The guy was in the Army at 17 and somehow got into a GI Bill program, got some training, become a pilot, and he's recruited by the CIA. So he's flying aircraft before you've got GPS, all this kind of stuff, any kind of aircraft. You're talking about a guy that, you know, not going to a long training. Here's the keys, take off, take a so-and-so. So, I mean, he's a survivor. He's got a PhD in street smart. So before he goes to John Kerry's, you know, committee following the subpoena to report to him, he goes to see a guy named Neil Matthews, who's a reporter in San Diego, and tells him the story. Neil writes a story called I Ran Guns for Uncle Sam, which basically is Tasha's testimony, right? And he gives him maps, names, a lot of names associated with Iran-Contra, okay? Then he goes to the committee, gives his testimony. The next day, they went back to Chest to really check on the testimony to see if they got it right. And he said, well, you can't look at it. It's classified. It's top secret. So too bad, guys. I already gave it to the press.
Can't even look at it to verify it.
Yeah, he's got, as I say, the guy's got a PhD in street smarts. Next slide.
Scott, this guy's impressive, isn't he?
It's good. I just want your slide right there saying it's a, you know, felony to traffic in cocaine. And then we tell the Justice Department through the federal court in Florida that the Justice Department is teaching a class admitting this, telling it to inmates. So you have a branch of the United States government teaching that another branch is engaged in murder and violations of the Constitution and felonies, and yet the court that has got a duty to launch a sua sponte investigation, they've been asked by me to do it, and they don't do it. And all of this is covered up. They have no legitimacy whatsoever.
And Robert, what was Kerry's response to this? How dirty has Kerry been for how long? Because when he came back from Vietnam, he was a guy in a white hat. He was doing good things and reporting our atrocities there.
Yeah, when Kerry was doing, he's in the minority party, right? So he did, he's calling guys in for testimony. He's doing the investigation, but he's running into roadblocks. He's not getting anywhere. And I don't know whether he threw in the towel at one point and said, well, the hell with it. I might as well join him. I can't beat him. I don't really know, but he definitely had enough. He had between Kerry and what else? Well, and other information that was available to.
Did McCain get involved in any of this?
I don't know. I don't know for sure. And if I don't know, I'm not going to really guess, but definitely
right,
Kerry.
Right.
Now this happens. Now Kerry. Now you've got Iran-Contra in 1987. All this information is available to the Iran-Contra hearing, right? No one at all mentions cocaine except for the one protester that comes in and screams out with a big, a big banner saying cocaine. Talk about the cocaine right before Ali North is sworn in. Ali North turned white. You could see his face. Oh my God, they got me, you know? And of course, the hearings immediately adjourn. The video cameras are turned off, and all of a sudden, we have Ollie North being sworn in again. And then
it's all papered over.
It's all papered over. Exactly right. We know about the Bolin Amendment. Talked about it a little bit. That basically, at one point in time, forbid. It was kind of like Edward Bolin was a Massachusetts representative who didn't want to get involved in another Vietnam War, and as most Americans didn't want to. Didn't want to see war in Nicaragua.
But it forbade assistance to Contras for overthrowing the government.
Yes, exactly. So he basically forbid the use of appropriated funds. So they go to private parties. They go to cocaine. They go to they go to third party governments, Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, a couple of other countries were kicking in money, but no question the majority of funds came from cocaine. Now the Iran-Contra committee had to know about that, yet nobody wants to talk about cocaine. Why? It goes right back to the executive branch, goes right back to the president of the United States, goes right back to lots of people involved in this thing. You know, when
Robert, this sounds like the Bolin Amendment's a great time for us to take a break. Is that right?
Yeah, it's good time. Good time.
Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal with my very special guest, Robert O'Dowd and Scott Bennett, talking about a whole lot of dirty business run by your government, including your CIA and your representatives, senators, and even judges on the federal branch. We'll be right back.
Less than 3% of you people read books, but less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing with Robert O'Dowd's account about corruption involving the CIA, murder of whistleblowers, and a host of related issues, with commentary from Scott Bennett, who is in Army Intel and PsyOps and has been an insider and a whistleblower himself. Robert, please continue.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, we're talking a little bit about Tosh Plumlee, whom you know. Tosh, who told me also that he flew not just pounds, but tons of cocaine from Central America into U.S. military bases, not base, but bases. And we know for sure that the bases that were involved were El Toro Marine Corps Air Station in California, March Air Force Base in California, Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, Carlsbad Air Force Base, and maybe others. and Scott flew, or Tosh flew into all these places using primarily the C-130A aircraft, which again had a payload of 10,000 pounds. I asked Tosh, I said, you know, Tosh, I looked at, well, you're telling me you're flying from a lot of these spots. You're flying from Costa Rica. I think it was a place called Santa Elena. You're flying out of there too. And I looked at the range, of the C-130. How'd you get up to El Toro? The 130A didn't have the range. So he said, well, we had all these stops that we would refuel in Central America and Mexico, where we had, you know, pre-positioned fuel, and simply would just refuel when we had to stop, load up, and just keep on going. So if we got a full load, which is 10,000 pounds, we got it in. There was money involved. And you're talking about a lot of money in 10,000 pounds. You're talking five tons right there, right? So, and with, I'm not even, well, it doesn't go, you can't sell it on the street, you know, per ton, but you can break it down to kilograms and you're talking billions of dollars here. So anyway.
I love that you've done all this research, Robert. I'm just really impressed. It's wonderful.
Well, I've kind of lived it for a while. I was at El Toro for 20 months back in the 60s, and I was in the now I was not attached to the 130 squadron, but VMGR 352, the third marine aircraft wing that flew the 130s, was right next to my hangar. They were in hangar 297. I was in hangar 296. So it's like when you wake up in the morning with a 296's engine, you know, turning over, you remember that. And I flew in many, many, you know, C-130s on hops back to the States, and Hops trying to get overseas also. Hops trying to get back to the East Coast. So I know the aircraft well. It was a good plane. It's a good plane today, as you know. It's still flying now, but different avionics, different engines, and everything else. But nevertheless, they're flying with the one. Now the question is, where did the 130As come from? Good question, right? We know for a fact that maybe one or two of them may have came from El Toro. Through the Air Museum. I don't know if I get these charts later on, but maybe if I jump ahead, that's okay. There was a scandal in the late 1980s called the aircraft swaps, you know, scandal. Between what happened was the Forest Service had to shut down all its C-119s or flying boxcars because of accidents. They were used to put out, you know, forest fires. So they're looking for aircraft, and a couple of guys we'll talk about in the future, Ray Reagan and a man named Fuchs, who worked for the Forest Service. Reagan's a lawyer and an Air Force pilot, came up with the idea of exchanging 130s in the Air Force's inventory that were in the Boneyard, which I think is in Tucson. I forget the name of the Air Force base now. It's just my number. Davis-Monham, is it? I think it's Davis-Monham Air Force Base in Tucson. Exchanging those 130s for 119s, which were junk. Basically, not that the 130As were not junk. They were certainly needed repairs. But in comparison to the flying boxcar, they were like, you know, catalogs compared to a Model T. So what happened is they exchanged these things, and supposedly the title was supposed to remain with the Forest Service. But what happened was the paper swings around the forest. What happens is the aircraft wind up in CIA proprietary airlines, and they get legal title to this stuff. So it was the government did not get the aircraft back. One or two maybe, but we're talking about for the most part, they stayed where they were. And instead of putting out forest fires, maybe a couple of them did, they're flying covert operations around the world, including flying these guns to South America and cocaine north. So that's where that came from. Next chart, Chance, if you would, please. Okay.
And Chance, observe that we're talking about $160 million per ton street value.
Oh, yeah. We're talking big money here. This is not small change by any stretch. And money that's not taxable, okay? Not on anybody's books, right? So that's even better. If you're on the receiving end. So, this is just real quickie. The government ignores the cocaine links to the Contras. We have the Joint Senate House Iran-Contra Committee ignores anything about the Contras or Ali North or anybody else. No one was ever questioned by them or by the special prosecutor with regard. The special prosecutor, let me take that back. Lawrence Walsh may have questioned some of these folks, but he never indicted any of them on a felony, which is cocaine trafficking. None of them. And the evidence was there. Ali North, our buddy Ali North, his diary contained multiple references to linking the Contras to cocaine, and he was linked to it also. He is questioned, obviously, intently by the hearings and also by the special prosecutor. Again, he's charged with, I think, something like 16 counts But none of those counts were related to narco trafficking. Nobody wanted to open the Pandora's box to cocaine trafficking because it just went too far. I guess. I'm assuming they knew it had to be approved by the top levels, the vice president, the president of the United States. They didn't want to bring them down, bring the entire government down. This makes Watergate look like a joke. Really. I mean, Watergate, I mean, Nixon, as bad as he was a crook. He wasn't running drugs into the country that I know of. I mean, these guys were not only running drugs, they're running a hell of a lot of drugs, and they killed a lot of people from this stuff. And anybody should be really furious about this. It would be the black community because they took the brunt of this stuff. They really got hit by it. They had kids that were addicted to this stuff, murders, rapes, killings, robberies, unbelievable. Senator Kerry, we mentioned Senator Kerry. Yes, his investigation did link the contracts of cocaine trafficking. The committee had that material. They could have used it. They chose not to. Salarina Castillo, he was reporting this stuff up in DEA reports. They could have gotten hold of those things. Nothing. Nothing came up there. And, of course, we mentioned the fact that Selly went to the reporter in San Diego and told his story. Iran, it was, and then the story is up on, in fact, the story is a book right now. It's in Barnes and Noble called Iran Drugs for Uncle Sam. It's a pretty good story. Next chart, please. Okay. This is a good video. This is, Michael Rupert, who has since died, you know, committed to, you know, suicide, who was a former DEA narcotics detective. Now, what happened from the publication of Gary Webb's Dark Alliance in 1996, there was a fury over this. So the CIA director makes the fatal error of going to South Central L.A. to calm the waters. Big mistake. So if you can run this chance, you'll get a kick out of this one. Hopefully he's got it. Got no video?
Robert, just tell us about it. Tell us about it.
Okay, walk you through it real quick. What happened was Deutsch, John Deutsch, I think it was John Deutsch. John Deutsch is a CIA director, and there's a room full, about 1,000 people in the room. Again, you're in South Central Los Angeles, which is predominantly a black, you know, community. They're furious about the crack cocaine epidemic that's running wild through their community. And they come to this meeting and try to protest what's going on because the rumor is the CIA is involved in it. So here's this guy that, one of the few white guys in the audience, who turns out to be a former LA narcotics detective who then tells Deutsch, and very calmly that look, I know for a fact I worked for the LA Police Department for so many years, and I know that the CIA was dealing directly in drugs in South Central LA and LA, you know, proper. Wow. The place goes crazy. And of course, this cost Deutsch his job as he was being nominated for Secretary of Defense. He never got that nomination. He's fired from the CIA or he goes off and that's it. That's the end of him. It is Deutsch, I think. So unfortunately, if you can get, the video's up on YouTube. Anybody has a shot, you know, take a look at it. Rupert, was a good guy, died too soon. Apparently he died from a gunshot wound to the head in Northern California. I don't think it was murder. It looks like I don't know for sure, but it looks like he just took his own life. He kind of had it. Next slide, please. Okay, right. Why going to El Toro? Well, as we said before, El Toro is right on I-5 and the I-405. I think that's how they pronounce it in L.A. And you're about 41 miles or so south of Los Angeles. And it's predominantly a fighter strip, but it'll take 130s. 130s can land anywhere, really. It can land on a dirt strip. It would take 130s. It probably could land. I flew in there on Air Force 141s. Interesting story. The first time we did that coming back from Japan, the guy had a wave off. And El Toro has mountains surrounding it. So you got to be very careful when you're coming in and when you're taking off. You crash into the mountains, you're not going to walk away from that one. So I thought, here I am coming back from a 13-year tour overseas on Air Force 141. Does this guy know El Toro? Because we get a wave off. You know, and if he doesn't come around right and land this thing, I'm not going to walk away. I want to get the hell out. I thought I was getting out. I didn't get out. As a matter of fact, what happened was the Marine Corps extended us involuntarily because of Vietnam. But anyway, that's so it's very close to L.A. and easy access, great base. And of course, the Marine Corps always ready to volunteer, right? You know this, Jim. Always ready to raise their hand. And the guy who was the chief of staff on the base at this time was a guy named Colonel Joseph Underwood. I think he may be in some follow-up slides that were coming up. But from the word get-go, Underwood was a close associate of Noriega. Let's put it bluntly, Underwood's a crook. Underwood is kicked out of the Corps in 1991 for misuse of government aircraft and a bunch of other stuff. He may have been also demoted in rank from full brigade colonel to major, I think. The commanding general on the base forbid him from coming on the base after he's kicked out, which is really kind of unusual. The guy, you know, normally they would let officers come back and play golf or go to the Oak Club or something, but he was, stay out of here. So anyway, the CIA 130 aircraft are using El Toro. You don't need a tower to come into El Toro. What happens is you can turn the, and you're talking Southern California, the weather's very good. You can turn the runway lights on remotely from the aircraft. So basically you're landing at 3 o'clock in the morning. 0200 in the morning, you know, the tower could be closed anyway for operations. The C-130 comes in, and nobody's going to wake up with the C-130 coming. It's an Air Force, or it's Marine Corps Air Station. They come in all the time. They taxi over runway 7L and then taxi over to the hangars in the southwest portion of the base. There's trucks waiting for them. They offload the stuff. How do we know this to be true? Because there's a Marine MP who was dumb enough. He's a good guy, God bless him, Randy Robinson, to write this stuff down and report, Staff Sergeant Randy Robinson. He's later on forced out of the Corps for some phony charges. He was told by the Provost Marshal, Randy can't write this stuff down. Not only did Randy write it down, but he told some DOD investigators about it. He was really in trouble. When I called him, he was really scared out of his mind. He said, stop poking the bear. I said, I'm not poking the bear, just give him a little bit of a hug, that's all. But Randy said some other things, and we'll talk about that later on in the following slides. Okay, so the 138 had the payload, had the speed, had the range. Next slide, please. See what's going on. Okay, just some names for if you're dealing in crack cocaine, I don't, but if you were involved, they would call it. They'd call it all kinds of stuff. Rock, sand, scrabble, sleet, snow, tornado, raw. It was all the same stuff. But basically, if you're in the ghetto in 1982, 1986, 1987, you don't have $250 to spend for a gram of cocaine. Maybe you got $10 or $20 to spend for a rock. Okay. And a rock, of course, would be the crack cocaine. That was the really addictive stuff. As I said, it delivers the drug rapidly to the bloodstream into the brain. 8 seconds, I think, is the average time. And the epidemic, as far as I know, I don't think it's ongoing. Maybe Jim knows, but it started in the 1980s and went through the 90s, and the community that hit the hardest was the black community. And, of course, it's diluted. The cocaine that came in, the stuff that's coming in is white powder. It's not crack cocaine. It's got to be diluted to be saleable.
Wouldn't that be a way to start your life, Robert, as a cocaine baby?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the crack cocaine babies. How many were living around? Like, my God, you're talking about being addicted in the mother's womb, and there's all sorts of developmental problems and all kinds of problems that would go on from there. You're talking about. We don't know how many people were affected by this. God knows how many. I mean, I guess that's part of the problem. If this was perhaps. If the cover blows on this, you're not only talking about the military guys and others who were murdered, you're talking about the effects on crack cocaine babies and on others who were addicted to this stuff and were involved in murders or were in prison. So hundreds of thousands of people, you'd have a massive riots on this stuff. So obviously if this was disclosed when President Bush was occupying the White House, he probably would be impeached, you know, and there's no way he can stand in the office. Next slide. Okay, we talked about money. You mentioned $127 million. Yeah, this is a conservative thing. You're talking about a 138 carrying, 10,000 pounds. That's the payload. That breaks down to 4,454 kilograms. And basically, if you do the math, that's $60,000 per kilogram. That's a value of $127 million. Not bad for one, you know, that's coming in. That's at the kilogram level. It's probably, now you're not going to get too many crack dealers maybe are buying at the kilogram level, but you're not, you know, on the street, you're not buying at that. So, you know, it multiplies. There's a multiplier effect here. Actually, what it, what the actual money on money you could get out of a 10,000 pound load. I don't know what it would be, but certainly a lot more than $127 million. And most of my information came from Tosh Plumlee, who's a good guy. And of course Tosh names, 50 other pilots flying. And he says personally that he and a couple other guys flew 40 tons of this stuff, 40 tons of cocaine into El Toro and Homestead Air Force Base, two bases. And as I said, also had March Air Force Base involved in Carlsbad and God knows what else, Mena, Arkansas. It was all kinds of places they were flying this stuff into. The best place you want to fly into is a military base because then you're protected. No one's going to open the aircraft. There's no customs agents waiting for you. You're clean. Next slide. Here's my aircraft. It's not a 130A. You can tell by the props, right? It's got four props. 130A's got three. I'm not sure what model this is, but it gets the general, configuration is a Hercules Lockheed, 130, which is a good aircraft. Scott, you may have flown in a couple of these things. I don't know, but.
Oh yeah, they're great aircraft.
Noisy, but, yeah. You get the old seats on the side. Yeah.
I'm convinced that the debris that showed up on the Pentagon lawn was dropped from a C-130 that was circling the building at the time.
It could be. It was probably a cruise missile that went in.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
But I'm talking about all the debris that wound up all over the lawn, including that piece from a 757 that actually crashed in Cali, exactly. Columbia in 1995.
Exactly. Let's phony this thing up, look like it's a 757. Yeah, we'll throw the debris out of a 130. Yeah, 130 could do it. Yeah, throw it out the back door. Make sure you have your chute on. Next slide. Actually, that's what broke the little side here. That's what broke the Iran-Contra door wide open, because the standing orders were from any of the box kickers. In fact, any of the guys that were flying the aircraft that were dropping supplies to the Contras in Nicaragua, don't wear a chute. Don't wear a parachute. So if you get hit by a missile, you go down in flames. You became a dead hero, right? Now the one guy who disobeyed it was who? Eugene Hasenfoss. I think that's pronounced his name, right? Eugene Hasenfoss. He wore a chute. He's a box kicker on a C-123 in October 1985, right? The aircraft is hit by a missile with some kid firing it, probably a Russian-made missile. It takes it out of the sky. Eugene's at the door. He jumps out. He's picked up. In his pockets, he's got Ollie North's number. He's got numbers to the White House. The gig's up. They got him, And, but the story had broken earlier in 1985 by, a couple of guys from the AP, but this really blew it open. They have Eugene up there and they're quizzing him. He's saying, I don't know anything. I'm working for a guy named Max Gomez, who's really, an AKA for Felix Rodriguez. Okay. And El Pango. So, there were some, Ollie North was in Europe at the time. It was a real quick scare to get back to the United States. And of course, that was 85 by 86, he's fired. He's out of the White House. Of course, he's well taken care of. He's fine. He's done very well for himself in Fox News, a best-selling book, et cetera. This was the swap scandal I talked about earlier, where it's interesting. It's happened in the, late 1980s. They needed 130. So what they did was come up with the deal, to swap 119s. Scott, this is probably before you were born. The aircraft, the 119 goes back to 1947. It's a flying box car, flying death car. They were crashing and they were using to put out fires and they weren't working. So they were grounding them all. So the fire service said, help, we need aircraft. So, these two characters, Fred Fuchs, who worked for the Forest Service, and Reagan, who was a smooth-talking lawyer, came up with the idea of exchanging with the Air Force Museum 130As for C-119s. Now, the Air Force kind of kicked in a little bit, said, we're not really too happy with this idea. But they did wind up doing it. There was something like, I think, the Oregon Press, reported 42 aircraft were, and actually more than that. Another guy said they're over 50. But a lot of aircraft went out. Now, the question when you do this, who has legal title? Legal title should have resided with the government, but in fact, somehow the airlines got legal title to it. So trying to get them back is pretty tough. So I think basically these aircraft stayed there for the most part. They were not returned to the government, and they got pretty cheap value for a pretty good aircraft. Obviously, they had to go through some rehab. Lockheed had at one time, when I worked for DLA, they had a separate line that was running down in Marietta, Georgia, to just rehab the old 130s. So they may have actually use them, I'm sure, fly the plane Vang or bring up whatever needed in terms of aircraft engine parts, avionics, replace what was needed and get the thing going. Next slide. Great plane, though. I don't know if you got this slide. This is, got this view grid. This is this is Gary Webb, who I think, although the coroner in Sacramento said it was a suicide, how do you shoot yourself two times in the head with a 38? That's pretty tough. So I think he was murdered.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. So anyway.
It's like Henry Marshall, Agriculture Department inspector who came out to find out if Billy Saul Estes actually had those cotton allotments he had as collateral, was found shot five times with a single shot bolt action weapon. He had carbon monoxide in his lungs. He'd been rendered unconscious, but the justice of the peace at the time declared it to be a suicide.
Yeah, go figure that one. So the fix was in, or some guys were standing in the while the autopsy took place, maybe, and told the coroner, "Look, you know, it's a suicide, isn't it? Okay, it's a suicide." I guess we don't have the video, so we'll go to the next chart. Next chart, Chance, if you will. Okay, well, this is Gary. Well, the last chart was Gary Webb's picture. So Dark Alliance breaks the CIA connection to the Contras opened in 1996. Gary Webb was working for a paper in the San Jose Mercury News, I believe, which is a paper in Northern California. He's castigated. He's castigated. His balls are cut off, really. The New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, really came after him. Of course, it's a small paper, so they buckled in. So it's, oh, Gary's wrong. So Gary's is put out in the field and eventually quits and walks away. So basically,
shouldn't he have quit, Robert? Shouldn't he have forced him to fire him?
Yeah, maybe. I think I would have done that, but they put him in the boonies someplace. Maybe his pride was too much. I'm not sure what happened, but you know, this guy's got to have post stress. I mean, he went through hell, you know, doing this thing. He was involved. He had lots of these. If you read the book, I'm not sure if you read Dark Alliance. It reads like a newspaper column. So if you're writing a book, you need more transitions. So they really followed the theme and what the hell. I'm reading the thing saying, great, great story you got here for a newspaper for a column, Gary. But look, the book is like, I got a copy over here. It's about 500 or 600 pages long. It's a big book. You know, so he was writing it pretty fast.
But were these actually all of his columns that he published about?
No, I think they could have done a better job editing. And I don't think that, but it didn't really matter. He was telling the truth, and they just didn't want it was supportable. He had all he had in footnotes.
Who's actually picked up on these incredible stories? I mean, what agency, entity, whatever, has ever done anything, picked up the ball and run with it?
No one. There's a guy working for a little newspaper in Northern California who just, is doing, ran into the story, but he didn't know about the aircraft flying into the military bases. He knew the Contras were getting drugs into the country. He didn't know how much. He knew it was a lot of it, but he didn't know the exact quantity. He didn't know they were using C-130 aircraft. He didn't know that. That would have been a
Scott, have you been familiar with Gary Webb's story?
In fact, that was part of the inclusion in Deep Black, the CIA class that the Department of Justice was teaching us. Gary Webb was all over in this as well.
Oh, fantastic. So someone picked up the ball, the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
Publish about it and put it into the prisons.
Yeah, they put it in the prisons just to teach these guys, hey, look how badly you've been betrayed. So go out
that's
and
really, yeah, that's really going to generate disrespect and contempt for the government.
Yeah, go burn everybody down. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Anyway, but.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is GEO, the big Bush, backed GEO Services, which is one of the contractors that does the jails in America, they were the ones who were pushing this. So they did it to get more criminals, put more criminals into their jails.
It means more money, right? Yeah, it's all about money in the end anyway. You know, it's all about the green. So that's, these guys have no morality whatsoever. Actually they should be on the other side of the jail, inside the jail, and the guys inside the jail should stay there too, but obviously we got problems. So he was, Gary was dealing with, basically thought really the Contras were dealing with these two Nicaraguans, Blanton and Menendez. I'm probably screwing up the Spanish here, but, I think Blanton was down in the LA area, and his compatriot from Nicaragua was up in the San Francisco area. So Gary thought what they were doing was running trucks back and forth down I-5, and they were doing some of that. But yeah, it's easier to bring a C-130 in El Toro and offload 10,000 pounds than it is to run a truck up to San Francisco and back again. You know, but you know, no one's going to tell them, right? You know, Marines keep their mouths shut, right? So some did and some didn't. The guys that didn't want them did.
He did pretty well getting as far as he did before he was taken out.
Yeah, he was taken out in 2004. So died relatively young guy. I mean, you know, but nevertheless, it was also at the time they either separated.
He deserved a Pulitzer Prize, for God's sake.
I agree. Even posthumously. And I'll nominate him for it. If I have any say, which I don't. Next slide. It was a farce, no question. Just say no. This is Nancy Reagan's response to the crack cocaine epidemic. Just say no. Oh, gee, Nancy, that's going to work. Why didn't we think of that? She actually went on national television with that. Just say no. That'll solve the whole thing. Hey, you're the guys who are bringing the damn stuff in, you know? You got to say no to your husband and to Mr. Vice President. Tell him to say no. Stop bringing the stuff in. That would stop the crack cane.
That's right. That's all it took. Nancy Reagan. She knew what she was saying.
Yeah, right.
She was right there. She was controlling the flow of drugs in the USA. God, unbelievable.
I don't know what Nancy knew or didn't know, but she didn't know what you're talking about in terms of cocaine. That was for sure. Next slide, please.
In all, he remained in good standing with all those guys right up to the end, did he not? I mean,
he's in good standing today too, no question about it. You know, makes a lot of money from Fox. Here's the first Marine this is actually the second Marine officer that was murdered. Now, officially, it's a suicide. Colonel Jerry Angibroad is found hanged in the BOQ 30 days after retiring from the Corps. Now, his job at El Toro was in charge of the aircraft museum at one time and in charge of the writing civilian contracts. Gee whiz, one of those contracts had anything to do with refueling CIA proprietary aircraft, I think. You think? And maybe they think, well, this guy's going to blow the whistle on him. We got to get rid of him. So that was one of the things.
You're talking here really about a bunch of apologies for his death intended to divert attention from what actually happened.
Yeah, he's killed. He's killed. He's hanged. But it's a suicide.
Officially, it's a suicide.
Yeah, and of course, officially, the death of Colonel Jim Sabo.
He just knew too much.
He knew too much, and he couldn't. And then it's another guy. It's interesting. I'm going to talk about him here a little bit, but there may be three colonels involved in this. And the other guy's name is Ron Fix, who was a colonel also who did the same function. Interesting enough. Oh God, this goes back to 1991 now. 91, Ron Fix had the same job that Angibroad had later in the later 90s, and he was in charge of the civilian contracts, the Air Museum, all that good stuff. And his name is mentioned in a series of notes between Rich Wayne, who was a Marine Corps reservist colonel called to active duty, who works for the Justice Department to put out fires, between him and a guy named Colonel Lang, who was the deputy adjutant general for the Marine Corps. And their conversation was centering around how they could convince, talk about a bunch of idiots, how they could convince the Sabo family, David Sabo, Dr. David, Dr. John David Sabo, and Sally, that their husband and brother was a crook, and not to go to the media with the story about what they knew about what happened to him. So they've got, and a guy writes these notes now, some good old Marine, probably enlisted guy, got a copy someplace in a Xerox machine, wiped off his prints, and mailed them to Dr. David Sabo. So we have the notes from Rich Wayne to Colonel Lang, and later on in the court case, while he's being he's been questioned by Dan Sheehan, the attorney for Dr. Sabo. He agrees, yeah, those are my notes. So here's why it's important. He mentions that Ron Fix has a girlfriend and it makes frequent flights to D.C. He's talking about misuse of government aircraft. Now, Fix was commissioned in 1963. He was going to go the full 30 years. This is 1991. All of a sudden, the guy retires in June 1991. Now, do you think that Wayne Rich, when he came to El Toro in March 1991, maybe had a conversation with Colonel Ron Fix? I think so. Time for you to leave, buddy. Now, all of a sudden, now, Fix dies unexpectedly. That was the obit in Texas in 2006, I think. Now, can't find out what the cause of death is without contacting the family, but that I understand from my folks and who are in the Midwest, and Jim, you're a Midwestern guy, that is sometimes used as a euphemism for a suicide. I don't know if that happened or not. We don't know.
Well, Robert, I think the point you make at the end about the government having an assassination team in the DOD Pentagon with the job to murder officers who are a threat to blow the whistle on covert operations, I mean, that's really something. Scott, have you run across that? Are you aware of such a team?
Well, I just know in Deep Black, again, our lovely little class taught by Eric Holden, Lanny Brewer in the Department of Justice, they've talked about the Mossad being instrumental in the assassination of military officers and journalists who were blowing the whistle or asking questions. And there were also ties into, well, I mean, Deep Black goes into the American POWs in Vietnam and dead bodies being shipped over from Vietnam with drugs sewn into them.
Yeah.
But the murder of, American Special Forces guys who were, you know, objecting to this, investigating this, looking into this, they were killed by, I think it was Moriarty, and Chip Tatum knew, this guy, knew this assassin, and Chip has his own background in that area. But I think any assassinations that, probably have taken place were done in coordination or by teams that were Mossad, CIA, not military. I have a hard time seeing some military men killing their own unless they're completely, you know, mad and lobotomized, which is a big possibility.
That could be. You've got, Karen Griggs. You know, Karen Griggs is the former wife of Colonel George Griggs. She had his diary. Now, he was an alcoholic. He may have been talking like a drunk. Who knows? But he talked about he was in charge of the hit team for the Marine Corps to take guys out. And it involves of all kinds of abusive sexual weird activities. I won't even go into that. It would just make you vomit. You never know. I mean, you can get all kinds of psychopaths, and you can recruit them and put them in a uniform, and they can get access. It could be anybody.
Well, I saw them at the highest levels of Central Command, too. I saw guys who were full-bird colonels in the Marine Corps and such coming into briefings who were as mad as hatters. I mean, their eyes were bugging out of their skulls, and they were red-faced, and they looked like they had just been running 5 miles. And they were just, you could tell they're out of control. And it was one of the weirdest things I could ever imagine. I thought, these are supposed to be the elite aristocrat of American society in command of military operations and military men. These are supposed to be the epitome of the best kind of Americans, you know, as we were raised. And yeah. I come into the environment, I think, you guys are a bunch of idiots. You're retards. You're thugs. You can't spell cat. And somehow you're thinking honor is tied to how many ribbons you have on your bureaucrat uniform. It was a sickening revelation.
It takes all kinds, right? And you see some of the people driving, and you really question who these people are. So all things are possible.
Yeah.
Where this story really broke for us was a guy named Gene Wheaton. Gene Wheaton, who was a great investigator, a good cop, worked. He was an ex-Marine. There's a lot of Marines involved in this thing. Marines, but he winds up as an Army warrant officer and retires from that. He's also fluent in Farsi. He's got a couple of master's degrees. Very bright guy. Gene was recruited by this team. So he's the one that said, hey, there's an assassination team within the DOD Pentagon, and their job is to kill officers who are going to blow the whistle on covert operations. These are, wow. So he said, hell, I do all kinds of stuff, but I'm not going to do that. So he walked away from that. And then later on, Gene was involved. He talked about, CIA Airlines, the Arrow flight that went down in Gander, Newfoundland in 1985. Are you familiar with that flight? 256 or so, 101st Airborne troops, Army troopers, right? They're coming back from the Sinai Peninsula. They had on a peacekeeping mission. And there was something in the belly of that aircraft. And what we think is, what Gene think was, what had happened was this, is that this is during Iran-Contra, that we apparently sold some bad toes or hawks to the Iranians. So they were, from a kind of a payback, point of view, they were going to blow some people up. So they planted a bomb in the aircraft. And what happened was the aircraft, The autopsy shows that these men had died from an explosion in the aircraft. They had, you know, smoke and other, you know, toxic chemicals in their lungs. You don't get from anything else but from an explosion. They died there. Yet the official report took 3 or 4 years to get out from the Canadian, you know, authorities, and that said that was icing. And there was no icing incident involved. And I think there were 9 people on the board, odd number. And the people who were really experts were 4, and they said, bullshit, there was no icing involved. And Gene goes up and does the investigation and finds out there's explosive stuff. He's called in by one of the general grade officers that he knew in the Army and said, look, Gene, I like you. You're a good guy. You're a loyal American. Stay the hell away from this or you're dead. They're going to kill you. So Gene says, okay, I'm out of here. He walks out of that one. We lost our charge for some reason. I'm not sure what happened here, but
no, it's being rebooted. We had a technical issue to keep the focus.
Okay,
Scott, would you like to add a few thoughts about where we are at this point in the discussion?
Well, it's interesting. You know your position from triangulation and training. So we've got, you know, you and Robert and myself triangulating to determine what is the point of truth. And we're exactly precisely triangulating that the United States CIA secret drug wars are a reality, and the CIA and the military complicity and the judicial system and the president's complicity and members of Congress have been violating Americans, violating their families, poisoning and killing Americans with cocaine, being hypocrites and trying to say, just say no in this silly campaign that occurred in the 80s. I mean, I was younger, but now we discover all this, and then I go down the rabbit hole, and I go to a halfway house, and they're teaching this class to inmates, and this is the Department of Justice, and I'm a qualified intelligence analyst. I've been in the military. I know this stuff. In fact, my job was to track down money sources and drug sources that were used to finance terrorism, and when I report to the judge, Judge Virginia Hernandez Covington, in the Florida District Court in Tampa, all of this stuff, she refuses to do anything. She drops it. She shuts me out. They try and stop me from getting my case in. And it's just a demonstration that these people have no honor. They have no constitutional integrity. They're not honoring their oath. And we all have raised our hand and took an oath to the Constitution. And that means something to us. It doesn't mean something to Judge Virginia Hernandez Covington. It doesn't mean something to Eric Holder or Lanny Brewer. It does not mean anything to Obama. It doesn't mean anything to Hillary Clinton. So the question is, if it means something to the American public, what are they going to do about it? What are you going to do, Americans? And the answer is, you better get down to these town hall meetings and make this known to your fellow citizens. You better go to your churches and your Rotary clubs and your veterans clubs and make this known. You better send this link out that is Jim Fetzer's show to everybody who's got a computer. And you better go down to your federal courthouse and start filing legal complaints or lawsuits that incorporate the violation of laws, because if you don't, you are going to be further victimized, enslaved, if not killed, as we've seen
it
happen in Oregon.
It's great you made these points right now, Scott, because we do have the video of Michael Ruper testifying to Congress to close the show, and that runs about 5 minutes, so it's perfect. And here we have the report about Eugene Hassenfuss, Robert, for you to pick up, where he was really putting Ollie North in considerable jeopardy.
Yeah, Eugene's smart. He's got a chute on. He's wearing a chute against standing orders not to wear a chute. He's kicking this stuff out of the aircraft, right? It's a C-123 on top of that. It's not an up-to-date aircraft. Unfortunately, the 3 other men on the aircraft all died. So the thing is hit by a Russian missile, goes plump down, going. Eugene jumps out, he pulls the chute. He hits the ground. He's picked up, and they question him. He says, "Yeah, I'm working for the CIA. What's the problem?
What's the problem?"
Well, he's a Marine. You know, he's not thinking that far ahead. So. Yeah. And he pays a price for it. I think some senator had to get him out of the Nicaraguan jail he was in exchange for somebody else. But, you know, he's just one of the guys just doing the, making a couple of bucks, you know, kicking some stuff out of an aircraft.
Now you have about 10 minutes for the rest of the slides in order to work in the Michael Rupert's testimony to Congress.
Yeah. Can we get down to some of the Colonel Sabo stuff? I mean, here's a good one. Here's a good one. Colonel James E. Sabo. Assistant Chief of Staff, Marine Corps Station El Toro. If there was a straight arrow Marine, it's this guy. 221 combat mission, straight arrow, you know, honest guy, Roman Catholic, would never think of killing himself, right? The night before he's killed, his next door neighbor, Joseph Underwood, the Noriega, the Chief of Staff who had been removed, tells him, look, Jim, you can't push this alleged charge of misuse of government aircraft you're not certified to fly to a court martial because the damn planes are flying in drugs. And I don't mean pharmaceuticals. So Sabo says, what the hell are you talking about? So I'm talking about cocaine. So he turns white. He says, what? Cocaine? I'm going to demand a court martial. Hey, Jim, put on your street smarts here. Hey, these guys have really, you know, you better pack something with you because you're in trouble. That night he has a 65-minute telephone call to the retired 4-star deputy commandant of the Marine Corps. Sabo had brought in the Harriers to the Marine Corps. He was well known. He should have been a general grade officer, but he was too honest, so you can't make him a general grade officer. He was going to retire in 3 years as a full American colonel. He had, or less than 3 years. Yeah, about 28 years then. So he calls this guy. I think his name was Davis, I believe. General Davis. I could be wrong on that one. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry, General Davis. But anyway, he calls a 65-minute telephone call. His wife is a witness to the call. Tells him the story. Hey, look, I'm not certified to fly these planes. What the hell are they talking about? I couldn't misuse aircraft. I'm not certified to fly. I'm going to really push this thing. So he's calm down. I'll take care of this. I'll talk to General Adams about it, who was the CEO on the base. It'll be all straightened out. The next morning, the very next morning, it's a Tuesday, the day after Martin Luther King holiday. Sabo decides she's going to go to church. I don't know whether she did it every day. That saved her life. She was going out the door. She's heard the phone ring 3 times. She answers the phone. Nobody's there. He was watching the air war start off in the Gulf War, 1991, January 1991. And the next, he comes back from church. She'd gone shopping, also saves her life. There are 3 guys there who really killed him. They're waiting for her to come back so they can make a suicide murder pact. You know, she doesn't come back, so they have to leave for the moment because there are too many people coming onto the onto the Sabo residence. There would be, you can't kill that many people. You know, it's going to be eventually somebody's going to say murder. So what happens is she gets back in, the TV's on mute. The dogs are in the garage. That was his practice every time Joe Underwood came over. Why? Because Joe Underwood was scared to death of his dogs. Always locked the dogs up. Now maybe somebody else came over. I don't know, but there was a gate between their fences. They were next door neighbors on, this is on Fifth Street at El Toro. Theory, I'm guessing. Here's probably what happened. Underwood probably called him, got him to come out to the patio. He's met there by 3 unexpected visitors who were there to do one thing, kill him. And so he's bludgeoned to death with, I'm not sure if it's on this chart or not, but it'll be a following. He's bludgeoned to death, and the autopsy shows this, that he has a huge concussion on his right side. And, you know, you don't blow your brains out. You blow them out. You don't blow them.
You don't beat yourself to death.
Yeah. You can't do that. You can't do that. And how do you take, and they go up and they get his, there's no fingerprints on the shotgun. Okay. It's a 2-barrel, 12-gauge shotgun. 1 barrel is fired off. There's no blood. I mean, you've got.
I think calling the 4-star was probably not the smartest move made.
No, it's not the smartest. I had a Marine Corps, my Marine Corps colonel tell me that. Not the smartest move. The smartest move might have been, he had a very good friend named Lieutenant Colonel William Callahan who had retired and was flying for Western Air or something. And probably the smartest move would have been to get your wife someplace else and get your kids someplace else. If you have to stay there, which you do, and start packing your .38, which he carried as a pilot. Or a 45 or even a long rifle, because guess what, Jim? They're coming after you. Because if you push for a court martial, and at the same time, he wasn't restricted to quarters. Get in your damn car, go off the base and talk to the LA Times. Tell them what you know. Tell them what you know.
In those days, speaking to the Times might have had effect. Today, they're all controlled, you know.
Yeah, they're media, exactly. They're all CIA controlled, so it wouldn't have done anything. Today, the best thing you do is pack a lot of stuff. So it would be hard to say it was suicide because a lot of rounds going off, you know.
And you got a few other, go back, Chance. You got a few other deaths here that we're talking about, too.
Okay.
Egan Broad, Tom Wade, Cameron.
Oh, yeah, Tom Wade. Tom Wade, interesting story. Tom Wade. Tom Wade is an enlisted Marine, right? I'm not sure what rank. May have been Staff Sergeant. He was about ready to get out of the Corps, but he's the computer guru on the base. He's the guy that knows how to take care. He can purge files. He's the guy that can do anything you want. So I kind of skipped something here. The Marine IG comes into El Toro at the start of the Gulf War, 3-star general with the staff, to come in to look at potential misuse of government aircraft. You don't need a 3-star general to do that. I mean, at the start of the Gulf War, what the hell is going on here, right? They go right to the IBM Center, which is building 53 on the base, and they go up and say, we want to see the MWR file. That was a civilian file. Okay, we're not talking about handing out, you know, tennis rackets. We're talking about the civilian file. They want to see that civilian file. So Wade comes over and says, sir, sorry to report the file's been purged. Well, of course, Wade had probably purged the files on the order of somebody else, probably Colonel Underwood. Wade knew too much. Wade was getting out of the Corps that year in 1991. All of a sudden, a promotion comes down. He's promoted, transferred off to the base. I think it was someplace in Florida, maybe Blunt Island. Then there's some time. They always give it some time that would elapse between the, you know, the events that allow for some, you know,
Right, so no one will assume that
the connection, exactly. So Christmas Eve, I forget what year it was, maybe 94, 95, he's yanked out of his car. His daughter was in the backseat of the car. She might have been 4 or 5 years old. I think he probably told her, probably the smart to say when someone came over, get down and keep quiet. They didn't see her. He shot twice in the back of the head. Now, the amazing thing is it's a civilian apartment, right? Marine MPs come in, cordon off the entire apartment complex. As they go through his apartment looking for what? Was he keeping some copies of the tapes? Did he have some records that would tie back into the government? Yeah, they were looking for something. And it was just listed as a murder robbery. It's still an NCIS cold case. Good luck on that one. They're never going to find out who did it because guess what? It was a government hit. No question about it. The guy knew too much. They just got rid of him. Shame, really. Should have got – even if he got out of the court.
Not even Mark Harmon could solve that one.
No, that's right. That's right. Now, this guy, Kevin's interesting. This is interesting. This is where it doesn't pay to be in the Army and have the same name as a guy who was in the Marine Corps. Kevin is a pseudonym for a guy who was in the Marine Corps who was a Native American in North Dakota, one of the tribes up there. What happened was somehow, I don't want to embarrass anybody telling you who it was, somehow someone innocently told a DOD investigator, I know that what we told you about Colonel Sabo and the drugs is true because this Native American was actually flying some of the stuff down into Mexico for some reason. He can tell you it's true. He's in this, and his name is so-and-so. And he's in, okay. So what happens is they find the guy hanged in his father's barn. They hang the wrong guy. They hanged a retired Army veteran with the same name. So the Marine veteran, the word goes out on the top of all fronts. Yeah, hired the wrong guy. Not the smartest angel, not the smartest brains on the earth doing this stuff. So the drums go out and words came back to Dr. David Sabo. We love you, doctor, for all your pro bono work, but please, no white man was going to come up here at all. Because if you do, guess what? You're not leaving. There won't be a question of any hair. There's no body. You're dead. This guy and of course the reservation police, they're just going to kill you all. You're dead. You're dead. So if you kill one of us on a reservation, we're going to kill you.
It's good to have friends.
It's good to have friends or good friends like that. Now, the other guy, I don't know his name, is a Pendleton Marine that a guy named Bill Taylor, who's an investigator, a CID investigator for Dan Sheehan, had contacts, was also in the Marine Corps as a CID, goes down to Pendleton and looks at, I don't know why he didn't get it. They went at the chopper manifest that threw the hit team in from, it was, you know, the mail run that goes on the Marine Corps bases. You're probably familiar with this, Jim. From Pendleton to, El Toro to, et cetera, all around Southern California dropping off the mail. Well, this chopper was bringing in 4 guys that day. 3 were actually involved in the hit. The 4th one may have been a lookout. I don't know. The 3 were talking about what team we were a part of. We don't know, but they had credentials because later on, I'm not sure if the other charts show it. Later on, they go back after killing Sabo, go back through the gate in Underwood's. This is theory. Go back in Underwood's house, change back into their clothing. They didn't pick up all the they didn't pick up everything. They didn't clean the crime scene yet, right? You'll love this one. Then they show up to the crime scene later. They go by the Marine guard at the front, who is now the chief of police for Flint, Michigan. Okay. Go by. He's a reservist called to active duty. He doesn't know anything. I don't know. Probably a Lance Corporal doesn't know anything. They go by, flash some badges and keep on going. You get badges in a 5 and 10 cent store. Come on. They go into the crime scene. Now, you cannot go into a crime scene and order anyone off of that crime scene. That's a felony in itself, okay? These guys can get in a big argument with the crime scene name skipping me. Cheryl something, I'll look it up anyway. Cheryl Baldwin, I think is her name. I could be wrong on the last name. Get a big argument with her and say, look, get out of here, go across the street, we'll tell you when to come back. What? I had a big argument with the Marine Corps colonel. He said, well, they had no authority to arrest anybody. I said, really? They had arms, right? They had weapons? That's all you need. You draw the weapons, tell them to get on the ground, lock them up. They can straighten this stuff out later. You can't come on. So they forced the entire NIS, and that day was NIS, and forced the entire NIS crime scene except for Cheryl and a guy named Bert Nagasone, who was a crook, works for the NIS, NCIS, probably today, SCS. I'll tell you how he's involved in it real quick. They go back, they clean up the crime scene, they got what was a 2x4 that was used to prop up the rear gate, probably used to kill the colonel. They probably had their own thing, I'm sure, but I don't think they got that. Maybe they didn't get that 2x4. Maybe they used it after they used their own billy club or something. I mean, they came equipped to take this guy out to kill him. But anyway, there was blood on this thing. They were cleaning up the crime scene, getting rid of all the evidence. And part of the things that they did, which was witnessed later on by a Marine again, Rainey Robinson, on the spot, Rainey, writing down the C-130s. Rainey is right on it. He's the second person in after Sally Sabo. Sally Sabo is the first person who discovers the body. She says, there is no patio chair on my husband's body. That's important because you need a patio chair to stage the government's, you know, suicide. Yeah.
Robert, you've done a brilliant job here. You and Scott have been sensational. We have just enough time to watch the testimony of Michael Rupert. And I got to tell you, I don't want to get you guys back again. This has been absolutely sensational. So this is a chance. Let's roll with Michael Rupert and his congressional testimony.
I will tell you, Director Deutsch, as a former Los Angeles police narcotics detective, that the agency has dealt drugs throughout this country for a long time.
That is an answer for a lot of you. Now, can you please?
I refer.
All right, now, can you please?
I refer direct.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute here. Wait a minute. If you don't like what's going on here, please leave now. No, leave now, because there are others who do want to hear what's going on in this room. Will you please take your seats? I will come back to you as we roll back across to the center section.
Director Deutsch, I will refer you to three specific agency operations known as Amadeus, Pegasus, and Watchtower. I have Watchtower documents heavily redacted by the agency. I was personally exposed to CIA operations and recruited by CIA personnel who attempted to recruit me in the late 70s to become involved in protecting agency drug operations in this country. I have been trying to get this out for 18 years, and I have the evidence. My question for you is very specific, sir. If in the course of the IG's investigations and Fred Hitz's work, you come across evidence of severely criminal activity,
let him speak into
and it's
mic.
Classified. Will you use that classification to hide the criminal activity, or will you tell the American people the truth?
All right, you want to hear the response first from Congressman Julian Dixon and then from the director. Wait a minute. I'm sorry, sir. I will allow the director to speak first and then Congressman Julian Dixon.
if you have information about CIA illegal activity in drugs, you should immediately bring that information to wherever you want, but let me suggest three places. The Los Angeles Police Department.
I'm sorry, others want to hear this answer. I am sorry, others want to hear this answer.
It is your choice, the Los Angeles Police Department, the Inspector General, or office of one of your Congress persons from this.
18 years ago, sir, and I got shot at for it. Wait a minute, sir.
And, sir,
you have not gotten the mic yet. You are not. But wait a minute, then. Don't speak out of turn.
Let me say something else. If this information turns up wrongdoing, if it turns up wrongdoing, we will bring the people to justice and make them accountable.
All right, Congressman Dixon.
Thank you, sir, for coming.
Wait a minute here. I thought you did not want to be here, but now that you are here, please let us hear and listen. Thank you very much.
Sir, I want to thank you for coming. You were at the last meeting. The staff probably had the spelling of your name wrong, but we would like to talk to you. We have been looking for a couple of days for you, and we want to we want to make sure that you contact the committee, because obviously you have some valuable information. If you want to give it to me privately, if you want to hand it to that aide where I can contact you this evening, please do it. Don't let us get away without getting a contact from you.
Thank you, sir.
If I pass it up to him now, so everyone can see that I got it, that would be fine.
Thank you, sir. And for the record,
please keep the noise down so that we can hear and we can get answers.
For the record, my name is Mike Rupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T. I did bring this information out 18 years ago, and I got shot at and forced out of LAPD because of it. I've been on the record for 18 years nonstop, and I'll be happy to give you, Congressman, anything that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Rupert.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guests, Robert O'Dowd and Scott Bennett, for being here, and all of you for watching.